The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, offering iPhone and iPad repairs, including liquid damage, cracked screens, failing batteries, and other issues. More information at techserve.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, in for John Hockenberry today. Thank you so much for listening. World leaders are gathering in New York today for the latest round of peace talks on Syria. And following Secretary John Kerry's meetings in Moscow this week, there is a renewed focus on presenting a coalition to crack down on Islamic State's financing options. The meeting before the UN Security Council today follows a summit of finance ministers chaired by Treasury Secretary Jack Lew yesterday.
A critical part of the U.S. whole-of-government strategy is the use of counter-terror financing tools and authorities to stop ISIL's operations by isolating it financially and economically. As many of you know, ISIL is a challenging financial target.
That's Jack Lew speaking to the UN Security Council finance ministers on Thursday. Since the 9/11 attacks, the Treasury Department has taken on the role of dealing with counterterrorism intelligence financing strategy. But the multi-million-dollar operation of the self-proclaimed Islamic State presents unprecedented challenges in dealing with the wealth of terror organizations. Joining me now is Jimmy Gurule. He was Undersecretary for Enforcement at the U.S. Department of the Treasury from 2001 till 2003. He's currently a professor of law at Notre Dame. Jimmy Gurule, welcome.
Thank you.
What is particularly difficult or troublesome about how ISIS finances itself versus, let's say, another organization we've heard about like Al-Qaeda?
Well, Al-Qaeda was principally funded by external donations, and so it was easier to track money that was coming in to Al-Qaeda. In contrast, ISIS is largely self-funded, and the monies are generated largely within the territories controlled by ISIS, and that makes it a much more challenging effort for the international community to go after the funding of this terrorist organization.
So what does that mean in the real world if you're a financial forensics expert? You have to find the banks in Syria or in Iraq where smuggled oil money filters through. How do you shut them down?
Well, that's the challenge. Not only do you have to focus on the banks that are moving the money for ISIS, but you also have to focus on the foreign businesses that are providing services to ISIS, for example, to develop and enhance their energy sector, more specifically the sale of oil. ISIS generates as much as $1 million to $1.5 million per day selling oil on the black market. So the Treasury Department is trying to determine who are the companies that are providing technology, services, parts to ISIS to assist them in facilitating the development of the oil industry. And who are the companies that are transporting the oil? Who are the companies that are purchasing the oil from ISIS?
So a lot of the revenue from ISIS's clandestine oil sales apparently goes right into Syria, and they appear to be dealing, as far as I know, with Bashar al-Assad himself. So what's the incentive structure here? How do we convince Assad not to buy that oil? Or is this a question of going and trying to cut off Syria from the world financial system so that the money's no good?
I think from the Treasury Department's perspective, it's the latter. If, in fact, ISIS is generating over $1 million a day from the sale of oil, that money has to enter into the financial services system at some point. The payment for the sale of oil can't be done in cardboard boxes. That amount of money has to be entering into the financial system. And so it's incumbent upon the Treasury Department to identify the shell companies and the shell corporations that are being used to conceal the movement of those funds.
Is this like water, though, that pours through cracks from somebody in your position? You can identify companies that are doing business, you can shame those companies or have sanctions to cut them off. But if there's an incentive there and there's oil and $1 million a day available, does somebody find a way to get at it despite U.S. policy?
There's no question that this is difficult work, and the terrorists are always looking for the point of least resistance. And so as soon as the Treasury Department or the international community shuts off or makes it more difficult to move money through the financial system, then they're going to look for less traditional, more informal means of moving money. And the Treasury Department then needs to be flexible and nimble to move to try to cut off those methods and means of moving money.
What does less formal mean? Does that mean duffel bags full of cash in exchange for a truck of oil? Does it literally mean that?
It can mean money transmitting businesses, money service businesses, for example. So that could be one means. ISIS may have to resort to smaller transactions and moving smaller sums of money through money services businesses like Western Union.
How sophisticated is the ISIS operation financially? They know that the world is onto them in terms of their oil sales, largely inside of Syria. There's this big UN meeting now. How adept have they proven to be to sort of go to ground financially and keep the money flowing?
Well, I think one thing is clear. I think throughout, the international community, including the United States, has underestimated ISIS. And so I think the worst thing and the last thing that the Treasury Department should do is underestimate ISIS's ability and sophistication and understanding of the international financial services system and ability to move money globally.
Jimmy Garuli, is the Senate underestimating that sophistication too? There's a nominee, a Treasury nominee named Adam Shustman, who has been nominated to be in charge of this type of anti-terror financing enforcement, and his nomination has been sitting in the Senate for many, many months.
Well, it certainly doesn't help when you have the chief federal law enforcement official responsible for the U.S. government's terrorist financing strategy being held up, being restricted in terms of his ability to take charge of this effort. That is certainly undermining the U.S.'s counterterrorist financing effort.
Jimmy Garuli is former Undersecretary for Enforcement at the U.S. Department of the Treasury. He was in that role from 2001 until 2003. Today, he talks to us from Notre Dame, where he's a professor of law. Jimmy Garuli, thank you.
Thank you.
Russia has certainly become a key player in the fight against ISIS and in Syria. Russian President Vladimir Putin appears to have found common ground this week with Secretary of State John Kerry's proposal to get a peace deal in Syria.
We think that the Syrian people alone should determine who they want to rule them, under which standards and which rules. So in general, I will say an important thing now. We support the initiative of the United States, including the one on the preparation of the UN Security Council resolution on Syria. It is this draft resolution that the Secretary of State brought with him. In general, we agree with it. I think the Syrian authorities will also agree with it when they look through the draft.
That's Vladimir Putin speaking at a news conference yesterday following what appeared to be a successful meeting between John Kerry and his Russian counterpart, Sergei Lavrov. But Putin's message was also a little more disjointed than in the past. He made some odd remarks supporting Donald Trump, whom he praised as being bright and talented, and also had effusive praise for disgraced FIFA president Sepp Blatter. And he also continued to express his scorn for Turkey over the shooting down of a Russian combat jet last month. Kimberly Martin is professor of political science at Columbia University's Barnard College and a friend of The Takeaway. Welcome back to the show, Kimberly.
Thank you, Todd. Great to be back.
And it's great to have you. Kimberly, what's behind the new language we're hearing from Vladimir Putin regarding the conflict of Syria with Syria? Why all of a sudden does it appear that Putin and Obama and Kerry might be on the same page when it comes to Bashar al-Assad?
Well, any agreement that we get is certainly positive, but I think the devil is in the details, and we have to keep in mind that despite this very positive talk, we also got reports today that Russia has effectively established a no-fly zone of its own over northern Syria. And in his speech yesterday, Putin said that this no-fly zone would keep Turkish planes from flying in the area, but we now know from the latest news reports that it is also keeping U.S. planes from flying in the area and giving to support to the anti-Assad and anti-ISIS rebels that we have been working with in northern Syria.
So how has this evolved here? Why does the U.S. think it has a partner now in Russia when it comes to Assad? Or do we really, or do we have no choice?
I don't think that the U.S. is thinking that Russia is a partner. I would be surprised if anybody were taken in by Putin's rhetoric, given all of the mixed messages he has been sending over the past 15 years that he has been president. But I think that we need to work with Russia as much as we can. And so if they express something positive, that is good to go with. But as you mentioned, he seems to have lost the sense of strategic messaging in his public pronouncements. So, for example, 2 weeks ago, he gave a state of the nation address to the Russian people in which he did not mention Ukraine at all. And then yesterday in his message, he talks about the fact that, oh, there were people in Ukraine who were filling military requirements, even though they weren't official representatives of the Russian state. He doesn't seem to be going in a cohesive direction in what he is saying.
At the same time, there might be some lack of cohesion, or you could say there is, coming from the White House. President Obama drew a red line a long time ago saying Assad has to go. The Russians support Assad, of course. He's an important client. And now, even though they say they're not, the White House and John Kerry seem to be backing off that red line that Assad cannot be president of Syria anymore.
I think you're right, but we have to keep in mind that the lack of cohesion has different causes in the two countries, because in the United States, the lack of cohesion comes from all kinds of different parties coming to the table and all having different political reasons for wanting to have a one message or another come to the forefront. And so it's a matter of trying to herd cats, essentially, that are all involved in the democratic decision-making process in the United States. Whereas in Russia, it's just Putin all the time. We don't know who's giving him advice. He may be changing his own mind, but none of what he talks about gets publicly discussed either before or afterwards. It's just him making these pronouncements. And so when we see inconsistency in what he's saying, it's more disturbing because it might be an indication that he is having some difficulty in deciding what his own strategic direction is going to be.
Well, before we let you go, Kimberly Martin, I got to get your take on Vladimir Putin's praise of Donald Trump. Does he see something of himself there? Is that why he likes him so much?
He's
or is this
really
just kind of adept trolling of U.S. officials? I think he's trolling Obama.
He's really kind of a Trump-like person, isn't he? I mean, he plays on the populism. He plays on the, what are close to being obscene remarks about Turkey and the United States. And he plays it to get at the common person and to get the support of the common person who says, yeah, this is somebody that I could see as a drinking buddy, kind of like Donald Trump.
Maybe two people of a kind, and I think maybe Vladimir Putin and Donald Trump both see a little bit of something to like in one another. Kimberly Martin, professor of political science at Columbia's Barnard College. Thanks as always.
Thanks, Todd.
Infamous pharmaceutical CEO Martin Shkreli is in the news again this week, and once again, it's for nothing good. Shkreli was arrested by federal authorities in his Midtown Manhattan apartment and charged with securities fraud, all related to his previous gig as a hedge fund manager. But before any of that, Shkreli got infamous, mostly on the internet, for his role at Turing Pharmaceuticals. Shkreli acquired the company, then raised the price of a drug called Daraprim 5,000%, from $13.50 a dose up to $750 overnight. Now, Shkreli defended his practices to CBS News in September.
The drug was unprofitable at the former price, so any company selling it would be losing money. And at this price, it's a reasonable profit, not excessive at all.
Shkreli was cast as a villain long before his arrest last night. But everything he did with Daraprim is perfectly legal, and it's a trend that other drug company executives, none of them as well known as Martin Shkreli, have been doing for a long time, boosting the cost of what were before inexpensive drugs. Joining us is Dr. Josh Sharfstein. He's professor of health policy at Johns Hopkins University. He's also the former principal deputy commissioner of the Food and Drug Administration. Dr. Sharfstein, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Daraprim is a generic drug, of course, and those are supposed to be way less expensive than name brand drugs because those patents have run out. I think we all understand that. It's an old drug from the 50s, so how did Martin Shkreli do this, make it so expensive overnight?
Well, you're absolutely right. What's happened over the last few years is that fewer and fewer companies are making individual generic drugs. And then at the same time, a group of other companies have decided that there's a way to make money by purchasing the ability to make the drug by finding the sole manufacturer of some of these generics and just jacking up the price to whatever the market will bear.
But if somebody like Martin Shkreli, and again, we should say he's not alone, if he jacks up the price, why doesn't someone else just come along and undercut him and say, well, there's no patent, we can make it too, and we'll only charge $20 a pill instead of $750?
I'm sure there's some companies that are working on doing just that. The problem is you just can't decide on Monday to be the competitor and Tuesday be in the market. The way that the generic drug market works is you have to prove to the Food and Drug Administration that your product actually is equivalent to the other medications and that the patients will be treated appropriately. And that is an application process that takes time. And unfortunately, the FDA has been quite backlogged recently. So basically, these companies are taking advantage of the approval process. People really hadn't seen this coming. So the price goes up on one day, and it may be a couple years before a competitor can get on the market.
So it's the most egregious case, Dr. Sharfstein. But look, we decided a long time ago that this is a free market country. Lots and lots of stories have been told about expensive pharmaceuticals, whether they're brand name or generic. So if we want to have a system where we don't set drug prices, where the government doesn't say the price is 50 cents a pill, then, I mean, this is what you get. It's okay to hate Martin Shkreli, but he can do it.
I'm not sure I agree with that. I think that there's a fundamental difference in the pricing of the new drugs that are coming on the market and these old drugs. For the new drugs, there's an important discussion to be had about how much it costs to actually do the research to develop the drug in the first place. And the companies that are selling them generally are the companies that did put in a lot of money to make drugs that can save lives. In the case of these generic drugs, there's no actual intellectual or research investment. It's purely a business strategy. And the strategy is to spot a generic drug where there's only one manufacturer, or buy that manufacturer, and just see how much money you can make and do, you know, whatever with the money. That's not something I think people think is fair.
Is there another potential downside here as well, though, I wonder? I mean, do we want to constrain the generic drug market? Promoting generics is hard enough, you know, especially with all of the political power of the name brand pharmaceutical giants. If we make it harder on generic companies, even though there are egregious cases like this, can we injure an industry that we eventually need, that we ultimately desperately need, to keep healthcare costs low?
It is very important to support the generic industry, and I think the correct policy response is not to say, well, I guess we should allow some people to take advantage of a brief monopoly situation and just fleece everyone for no good reason. I don't think that's the solution. I think a better solution is to think about how to get the generic market to work more effectively, how to get competitors on the market more effectively. So I'll give you an example. One idea that we've been talking about is the idea that rather than just have a long queue of generic applications, FDA should push to the front of the line those applications that would address a monopoly kind of situation like this, so that there's a much shorter period between the time a company wants to be a competitor and the company can get on the market. That promotes competition and promotes a healthy generic market.
Another thing that Martin Shkreli did here is he bought up the entire supply chain, as I understand it, so that he controlled every pill. And that meant if another company, as they have the right to do, wanted to buy the pill so they could copy it, which is all you really do in that business, they couldn't even get a hold of it because he didn't have to sell it.
It was a disaster for patients. I mean, let's just be clear. We had a patient who couldn't get the medicine, and they weren't answering the phone over the weekend and was suffering. The patient was suffering from significant effects, including not being able to speak. I mean, so you can see that when you permit a business strategy that has no value for the market, no value for the public, then it's not an abstract problem. People who are suffering are really harmed.
Dr. Josh Sharfstein is professor of health policy at Johns Hopkins and a former principal deputy commissioner at the FDA. Dr. Sharfstein, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
Today, the big budget, massive Star Wars enjoys its first full day on movie screens in the United States and across the world. We're going to hear the Movie Date team give us their reviews in just a moment. But way beyond Hollywood and made for a lot less money is another film empire attracting fans from all over the world. Tukana maso. Bino, wait. That's a scene from Who Killed Captain Alex. It's an action film that relies on two-dimensional helicopters and cutouts instead of big-budget CGI special effects. Ugandan filmmaker Isaac Nabwana is the man behind that, and a lot of other films, too. He produces them all in a neighborhood of Kampala called Wakalaga, where he also lives. At about $200 a pop with lots of homemade props, his films are about as low budget as they come. But they've amassed a cult following online. The most famous, I just mentioned, Who Killed Captain Alex, has been viewed on YouTube hundreds of thousands of times.
Then who killed Captain Alex? Who?
On a Skype line from Uganda, Isaac Nabwana explained to us that while he has great passion for film, he's not a trained filmmaker.
I just found myself, you know, doing it. In fact, I didn't know between the director and the producer. I didn't know the difference. And when I started, you know, shooting a movie, the first movie, which never came out, I found out that I knew how to tell stories, but I didn't know how to write scripts. So I had to help one drama actor who had a play, written play, to make it, to film it. So I learned very much how to connect, you know, scenes to scenes with that guy called Isaac Sempija.
Over time and over lots and lots of films, Isaac Nabwana has learned some mastery of his craft. But budgets are still a huge issue, and you can tell when you watch the films. He's had to enlist his creativity to get around that shortage of money.
Normally, we don't have enough money to hire locations, which sometimes we would like. But for me, I always utilize the location which I have here, my place here. I always change it. I sometimes put something which is not there, and I to make it, you know, different from the last scene, something like that. But the set is always with the actors and me on it, plus the disguise. You know, I sometimes disguise the actors because I don't have too many of them. Even their location, I disguise it, and I make it, you know, a different location, though it is the same location I use.
In the end, though, Isaac thinks audiences love his films for more than their inventive use of low budgets, wooden guns, wooden bullets. He credits something else.
It's action, basically, not motions, but it's action with comedy, some comedy in it. Like, you know, punching and, you know, you kick someone, big guns. I like that very much. Then, you know, with a big gun, you know, destroying a lot of, you know, stuff like, you know, buildings, you know, crashing to what. That is what I really enjoy in movies. Of all movies in the whole world, action is an international language. If you make an action movie, everyone will understand it very easily.
Isaac was always hoping that some people outside of his neighborhood would watch his films, but he never expected the kind of notoriety he's got now.
I think it has gone beyond what I expected. And when I was making it, I used to tell my fellow actors and actresses here that we might get problems with the government because we were going to use toy guns and, you know, some uniforms which are not, we did not have permission to. I expected that if we are not getting problems here, it will go international. But I didn't know, I didn't expect this much. I expected that it will go out.
Despite all the success, Isaac isn't sitting back. He's got lots more projects in the works, and he's been inviting fans to be a part of it.
There are so many movies I want to bring, I'm bringing, like Eaten Alive in Uganda, like Bad Black, Operation Kakongolio, The Expendables of Uganda. We are also doing Tabatu Sasula Ebora. In fact, I lost that one sometimes back, then I'm going to reshoot it. So that one needs a lot of people all over the world. People can shoot themselves, you know, dying on green screen. And if they want their villages to be blown up, something like that, if they want their aids to be blown, they just send footage and then I put it in my movie. It is fun, you know, it is fun. Films are for fun, for sure.
Isaac Nabwana is the writer and director of Who Killed Captain Alex, Tiger Mafia, Eaten Alive in Uganda, and dozens of other films. After you watch Star Wars this weekend, take my advice. You should go on YouTube and find Isaac's films. You can also find them at watch.wakaliland.com. And we have more from the Movie Date team on something a little bigger budget coming up next.
I am the father.
Houston, we have a problem.
I'm from Iowa. I only work in outer space.
I'm having trouble with the radar, sir.
What's wrong with it?
I've lost the bleeps, I've lost the sweeps, and I've lost the creeps.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
Ooh, it's a decidedly sci-fi outer space intro to Movie Friday here on The Takeaway. With me in studio are the hosts of the Movie Date podcast, Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday, and of course, Kristen Meinzer, culture producer for us here at The Takeaway. Welcome, guys.
Hi, Todd.
Hey, Todd.
Well, it's a huge day. There's no secret why we had the space intro there. Star Wars freaks everywhere have been waiting for the release of The Force Awakens. You guys are still a rare breed. You've seen it, right?
Yes, we have.
Okay, and we're going to talk about that in just a minute. But first, of course, trivia. And you know, of course, this has to be Star Wars trivia. So listen, we're going back to basics now with Star Wars. Don't answer yet. You're going to hold on to your answer. We're going to come back to it after the reviews to get the answer. Listen to this. You're about to hear Han Solo talking to somebody.
Yes, tell Jabba that I've got his money.
Song Bichale. Jabba wa ninchiko babushani.
Who is Han Solo talking to there? You get a bonus point if you can give the location. But the real question, Kristen Meinzer, is who is Han talking to there? Star Wars freaks know the answer. Hold on to it. And now let's get on to Star Wars The Force Awakens. I'm excited. We are in a no-spoiler zone, by the way. You guys are talented movie reviewers, so we know you're going to do this without spoilers because I'm seeing this on the day after Christmas. But Star Wars The Force Awakens is out. J.J. Abrams is the director. Everybody knows that. Here's a clip.
We can't outrun them!
We might! In that quad jumper!
Hey! We need a pilot!
We've got one!
You!
Oh, Kristen Meinzer, I'm only using the edge of my seat right now, even though I paid for the whole thing.
Well, that's John Boyega, who has decided to leave his job as a stormtrooper. He just cannot handle it anymore. He doesn't like to kill people. And after he's run away, he's met a young woman named Daisy Ridley, named Rey, played by Daisy Ridley. She's a scavenger who's just barely getting by in life. She's a little bit of a Luke Skywalker sort of character. She's wearing kind of the same natural fabrics as him and running around and being kind of a regular person. But the two of them team up along with a droid which has a map to Luke Skywalker. And along the way on their journey, they, of course, run into some old friends of ours, Han Solo, Chewbacca, Captain Leia now, not Princess
General.
Leia. Or General, I'm sorry. So we have a lot of nostalgia for the people who love the old Star Wars franchise. We have some new stuff. And I have to say also something that's notable is it's a lot more diverse and there are a lot more women than there were in the original, which I like a lot because when the original movies came out, I really felt excluded by all of them as a female and a minority. And this one, I feel much more included in.
Rafer, I was a real hater for episodes 1, 2, and 3. I mean, vehement, almost walked out once or twice. So am I going to be satisfied now and sort of and back to my happy place?
I think you will. I think the one good thing about this is that it really wipes away the memory of those prequels, which, you know, strangely enough, we all hated, and yet they made tons of money. I've never been able to figure that out. I've never met a single person who likes the prequels, and yet they all made millions upon millions of dollars. Yeah. This is far better than those, obviously. The new characters, I think, are very interesting. Harrison Ford, though, I think, is really magical in this film. You know, he's front and center in this film, as the trailers have hinted. And it's great to see him again. The other person I'll say who's terrific in this movie is Adam Driver, who plays Kylo Ren, the villain. I'll say no more, but he is fantastic. I don't think this is going to give you that same sense of magic that you got from the first three.
Yes, it will.
No,
yes,
I absolutely don't think so.
I am shocked that you're saying that.
You can't recreate the magic of the original Star Wars. It's like, you know, you can't reunite the Beatles. You can't recreate the first three Star Wars. But I think this movie does a good job. It's very, very post-Marvel, very Disney. It's well done. It moves fast. I liked it.
I thought it was outstanding.
All right,
and I think it's better than the first one, just so you know.
Oh, you do? Okay. Well, yeah. We're all excited anyway. I have a feeling that most people like me are going to see this film. I'm glad, Rafer. I'm glad you guys have given it a positive review. It's going to make me enjoy it more. Let's make sure we get on to Sisters, which stars Tina Fey and Amy Poehler as sisters who are having a high school reunion party in their house. Listen.
Are you serious? Because I am straight up baffled.
I'm sorry?
I believe you called this party a sad and desperate event.
Well, I just figured I'd pop in and say hello to everyone. I mean, we're all adults now, right?
I respect your jumpsuit, but not its contents. Hit it.
Fine. I have another function to attend anyway. Besides, I flushed a tampon down your toilet.
Your pad's all the way, and everyone knows it.
All right, a little bit of literally bathroom humor from Amy Poehler and Tina Fey. Rafer, what'd you think?
Well, I had high hopes for this because, I mean, these are two really great stars. Very funny. They're great writers. They're great improvisers. You know, the fact that they're playing grown sisters who are throwing a bash on their old childhood home before it's sold, you know, that gets me and right in my middle-aged heart. You know, I understand that. I just think this is a movie in search of a story. I think there's a lot of kind of, you know, weak one-liners. I don't think the characters are very well drawn. It's nice to see those two on screen when they're just kind of shooting the breeze with each other and making stuff up off the top of their head. They can be very funny, but there's not a lot to this film, and I never found that it rose to the level that I wanted it to.
Kristen, quickly.
I have to totally disagree with you once again, Rafer.
Really?
I think that this movie had a lot of heart. I love the characters. I love the way they interacted with each other. And it has some real awkward moments where you're laughing, but you're also feeling self-recognition. And I think that's a great balancing act. I totally laughed my head off also. So
bit
I have to disagree.
Bit of a buddy comedy and some real, you know, humor, sort of bathroom humor from Tina Fey and Amy Poehler there. That's Sisters. Okay, let's go back to trivia. Of course, we're talking Star Wars. Guys, you heard this conversation with Han Solo. Listen.
Una puta solo?
Yes, tell Jabba that I've got his money.
Zombie Jale. Jabba wa ninchiko babushani.
Kristen Meinzer, who is he talking to?
Well, he's trying to get in touch with Jabba the Hutt, but I cannot remember the name of that character that he's talking
Rafer
to
Guzman?
Get to Jabba.
Pretty sure that's Greedo in the cantina, right?
At Mos Eisley. Thank you, Rafer Guzman.
Whoa.
Sorry, Kristen Meinzer. We got you again. Kristen Meinzer, culture producer and host of the Movie Date podcast, along with Rafer Guzman, who gets the trivia right around here. They are the Movie Date team. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Todd.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. It's Todd Zwillick with you today. We are rounding up the year by bringing you a series of interviews, voices from changemakers on topics like policy and science, technology, and a whole lot more. We talked to the editor of one of our partners, The New York Times, on what drives the media we consume. Jake Silverstein has been editor-in-chief of The New York Times Magazine for about a year and a half now. He was brought on board in part to breathe new life into a shrinking industry. Now, The New York Times is, as I mentioned, one of our partners, and you hear a lot of their journalists here on The Takeaway. We didn't want so much to promote the magazine as point out some of the very new things they're trying while their industry struggles. The magazine relaunched in February of this year, and Silverstein and his team have been journeying into some pretty new territory for a print publication, virtual reality. It's a potentially risky venture that Silverstein says is working for them right now, despite the overall anemic health of the news industry, and that's never far from the back of his mind.
I'd spend a fair amount of time thinking about it, although I would say I probably spend more time thinking about the health of my particular magazine than I do about the whole industry. I mean, you know, I look for ways that the magazine can be more successful and that rising tide can hopefully enable us to do more and more ambitious editorial projects.
And so, of course, a lot of the recent attention that you and the magazine have garnered doesn't come from print at all. It comes from this new foray into virtual reality, which is exciting and kind of gadgety and gimmicky and neat and high-tech and decidedly unprint.
Yes and no. I mean, one of the things that we loved about this project was that the way we were able to differentiate ourselves at the New York Times from the rest of the media companies out there that are getting into VR is that we were able to deliver to our readers a VR viewer. The reason that VR hasn't really caught on in terms of journalistic usage up until now is that the end users don't really have the headsets at home. So what differentiated us was that we could distribute these Google Cardboard headsets that enabled us to bring an immersive VR experience to, you know, a million of our home delivery subscribers. And that really set us apart from other companies. And what did that was that we had a legacy print operation that can get, you know, actual tactile objects into the hands of people. So we thought it was kind of a wonderful kind of poetry to the project that our old media system enabled this new media experience.
And so if people don't know, you distributed to all of these subscribers a cardboard box about the size of a small brick. It's got two kind of thick Coke bottle lenses, and you stick your eyes in it and see a virtual reality. Let's listen for a second to a clip from your Paris Vigils virtual reality film that you distributed, and
sure.
Then we'll talk about it.
I lost a young friend on Friday the 13th, a friend who was at the Bataclan. He went to the concert. He wanted me to go to the concert with him. I worked late. I was feeling tired, and I didn't go. Now I regret it. I tell myself, perhaps if I were there, he would be alive.
So the clip that we heard was from on the streets in Paris at a series of vigils that had happened in the days after the attacks. And you would be surrounded by people who in almost every situation that we were in got to be so comfortable with the presence of the VR camera that they were not paying any attention to it. And so you really began to feel as if you were part of that crowd. You were just amongst all these folks. And that's the kind of immersion that VR enables, and it's what separates it from traditional video and from photography and also, you know, text as well. When the first project that we used VR for, an 11-minute film about the global refugee crisis in which we gave portraits of three children who have been displaced from their homes in that crisis, and as you experience these children's worlds, you began to feel a sense of connection to them, a kind of, you feel an empathy for the people who are seem to be right there in front of you. And it's that kind of connection, that sense that you are immersed in the place and it enables you to feel something for these people, that is, I think, different from other forms of media that we're used to. VR added to that whole project this really special dimension. It sort of cuts through all of that and it puts you there and it allows you to feel something that I think can really drive a journalistic project like this.
Well, at the same time, of course, with all of the enthusiasm are concerns. And I know you've heard these concerns journalistically, that journalism is supposed to be about being witness to events, not being part of events. And by its nature, this type of virtual reality production requires a certain amount of staging.
Well, first, I think that this is a form of bearing witness. In fact, I recall showing some early films from other producers to some editors in the newsroom, and they literally said, this changes what it means to bear witness. So we're not framing a shot for you. We're not pointing your eyes in a certain direction. We're putting you in a place and saying, look around, as if you were there yourself. I mean, we're very, very careful to observe all of the journalistic standards that accompany anything that we do. I think if it's done right, the potential for VR to be even more transparent than traditional video is absolutely there. You know, any new technology has questions that will arise around how it's put to use, and we're trying to answer them ourselves, and we hope to be a leader in establishing what some of the new journalistic conventions are around this medium.
You know, it's impossible, Jake Silverstein, to get around the fact that Star Wars comes out today. I'm excited.
It is
and
impossible.
A lot of people are.
I'm glad you brought it up.
It's impossible. Yeah, it's coming out. Everyone's excited. And a huge money event. Are you competing with this? Not Star Wars per se. Are you competing with this type of entertainment now?
I mean, we're competing with that type of entertainment. We're competing with people's social media feeds. We're competing with streaming on-demand television, the newest Netflix series. I mean, if somebody's going to binge watch Netflix, they're not going to be reading their New York Times Magazine. We have many, many competitors. The Times Magazine is a kind of a habitual weekend read. We're a magazine that is associated with a certain time of the week, and that's very useful to us in terms of competing with things like Star Wars or Netflix or what have you, is that, you know, people have a ritual around a Saturday morning or a Sunday morning when they sit down with their magazine, they can spend some time with it, and we believe that that gives us a certain kind of advantage, a certain kind of purchase on people's attention, and we really try to differentiate ourselves.
A sense of place and an experience of story. That's what the New York Times Magazine is going for in a new era of print journalism, struggling to compete, yeah, with Star Wars. It's true. Jake Silverstein is editor-in-chief of the New York Times Magazine. Jake, can I extract one promise from you before you go?
Please,
no,
what is it?
No VRing of the crossword, please. I like it the way it is.
You don't want to be in the office with Will Shortz as he's working on the crossword? Come on, that'd be amazing.
Not the virtual equivalent of doing it in Sharpie. That's a little too risky.
Yeah, I will make that promise.
Jake Silverstein, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And here's something to take with you today, a myth-busting study from the British Medical Journal. It turns out that all those Austin Powers jokes were wrong. Get this, American adults have more missing teeth than their British counterparts. That's right. American adults have, on average, 7.3 missing teeth. The Brits, 6.9 missing teeth. Now, one caveat, that calculation includes wisdom teeth, which Americans get removed much more often. They're counting those, okay? Nevertheless, do be sure to brush and floss as we head into those sugar-filled holidays. The Tooth Fairy has Christmas off. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick in for John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
So Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity, offering a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving. With brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program, performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.